Welcome to A Cotchard Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Akatra AI.
Welcome back. So today we're diving into Adam Lazar White's debut, King of Ashes. And wow, our sources have handed us something pretty unusual to unpack here.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's not just that the novel's complex, which it is, but it almost seems like we're dealing with two completely different books based on the source perspective.
That's exactly.
And I think that duality is a big part of why it got so much critical attention when it came out in 2022. It really shows Lazar White's range. I mean, he's an actor, a fantastic narrator, a screenwriter.
You're multi-talented.
Exactly. And you feel that background in the writing. He has this incredible sense for dialogue, for the rhythm of language, and, you know, getting deep into what makes characters tick. It lets him blend really sharp social critique with very deep psychological stuff. Absolutely. So our mission today really is to try and figure out how these two conflicting takes from our sources fit together. We need to find that core literary truth somehow. Is King of Ashes this cutting critique of modern American politics, or is it something else entirely, a kind of mythic Southern Gothic family tragedy?
Two very different flavors.
Definitely. So maybe let's start with the political angle first. That seems like one clear path presented.
Okay, sounds good. So this first narrative strand sets the novel firmly in, you know, contemporary America. The main idea is it's dealing with the fallout from a big political scandal. A powerful dynasty, the Kings, has basically collapsed.
And the novel doesn't just rehash the scandal itself?
No, it sort of jumps past the headlines. Mm-hmm. It dives right into the messy human consequences, the aftermath. And that really connects with a lot of the conversations people are having right now about power, privilege, systemic inequality, that kind of thing.
And what's interesting, based on the sources, is how it shifts the focus away from just the fallen king, Robert. Yeah. It seems to use that power vacuum to look at the people around the system, especially those sort of pushed to the margins by it.
Precisely. Yeah. The key figure in this reading is Marcus Thompson. He's a young black journalist.
Okay.
He starts out, you know, driven to uncover the truth, standard journalist mission. But as he gets deeper, he starts finding these complicated links between himself and the very system he's trying to expose.
Ah, so it gets personal.
Very. It stops being just about facts and becomes this, well, this really risky journey where he realizes that getting to the truth could end up wrecking not just the powerful people, but maybe his own life, his career, everything.
And then there's Sarah Chin, a former aide. Is that right?
Yeah, Sarah Chin. She really embodies the tough choices, the sort of moral compromises people, especially women and minorities, mm-hmm. often have to make to survive in those kinds of white, male-dominated power structures.
So she was complicit initially.
That seems to be her starting point. But the real tension now is her struggle over whether to testify, you know, become this reluctant whistleblower. It brings up all these questions about personal responsibility versus the pressure of the system itself.
And who represents the system fighting back?
That would be Daniel Whitmore. He's the powerful lawyer, the kind of figure who represents the old guard, just digging in their heels, resisting any real change, rationalizing it all, of course.
Got it. So the climax in this version forces choices on them.
Exactly. It pushes all three into these really impossible situations. Marcus has to decide. Does he publish this story that could absolutely destroy lives? Sarah has to decide. Is standing up for what's right worth turning against the people who gave her power?
And there was a third figure mentioned, Maria.
Right. Maria Santos. She's a community organizer, and her dilemma is whether she can actually fight for reform from inside her organization, even knowing it's been tainted, compromised by the King legacy.
Okay, this is where those really sharp, memorable lines seem to come from in the sources. It's clearly not just a simple good guys versus bad guys story.
Not at all. That theme of power and complicity gets summed up so well by that one quote. You probably saw it. Power doesn't corrupt, it reveals. It shows us who we were all along, just with the means to act on it.
That's powerful.
And if you think about Whitmore through that lens, it's quite chilling, isn't it? He wasn't made corrupt by the Kings. He likely already had those views, and the power just gave him the platform, the means to act on them without restraint.
Yeah. And the critique of the system itself sounds pretty unflinching, too. That line from Marcus Thompson.
Oh, yeah. The system isn't broken. It's working exactly as designed. The question is whether we're willing to admit we helped build it.
Wow. That really forces you, the reader, to think about your own role, doesn't it? Even passive complicity.
It avoids easy answers. It's asking uncomfortable questions.
Okay, so hold on to that image. The sterile offices, the financial power plays, the cold logic of DC politics. Because now we hit that collision point in the sources.
Right, the big shift.
If you look at the second set of source material, it's like the whole world changes. Suddenly, it's not cold logic. It's thick humidity, Spanish moss, history breathing down your neck.
It is startlingly different. We just completely pivot. Forget the DC backrooms. Now we're deep in the Louisiana Bayou. Sweltering heat, superstitions, myths.
So the focus shifts from political systems to something more primal.
Exactly. We leave the political critique behind and plunge straight into a Southern Gothic tragedy. It's all about family legacy, dark secrets, the destructive power of the past, and specifically this brutal, overbearing patriarch whose shadow just looms over everything even after he's gone.
A totally different vibe. History isn't in the archives. It's in the air, in the soil.
Mm-hmm. And the core conflict here is intensely familial. It's framed almost like a classical tragedy, centered on two brothers shaped or maybe cursed by what they've inherited.
Tell us about them. Rono is the older one.
Yes, Rono. He's positioned as the tormented protagonist. He's been groomed his whole life to take over, to be the next king of this little empire built on, frankly, violence and control.
So his path is set.
It seems like a downward spiral. He's trapped by this inherited rage, this, you know, toxic masculinity. The tragedy is that he's basically consumed by this legacy he feels compelled to live up to, even as it destroys him.
Sounds like a classic tragic figure. And Zala, the younger brother, is he the contrast?
Completely. Zala's the sensitive one. He's desperately trying to carve out his own identity, separate from all that violence and expectation.
Seeking escape.
Yeah, he wants a life focused on art, empathy, things that within that family structure are seen as fundamental weaknesses. So his journey is about rebellion, trying to break free. But he's still deeply, tragically tied to Rono.
How so?
Well, the sources describe Rono's love for Zala as possessive, almost like a cage. The protector is also the persecutor. It's incredibly complex and suffocating.
Wow. And what sparks the main conflict between them?
It's the return of Jo. She's described as this resilient figure who shares a really deep traumatic history with both brothers.
The past comes calling.
Exactly. Her reappearance just rips open all these old wounds that have been festering for years. It forces Rono and Zala to confront the poisonous roots of their relationship. It becomes about blood, land, history, not politics.
So the key theme here is really about legacy, the inescapability of family history.
Absolutely. It leans hard into that deterministic idea, yeah. You know, that your fate is basically predetermined by your bloodline. There's that quote, capturing it. A man is what his father makes him. You can fight it, but the blood knows its own way home.
Chilling.
And it leads to this devastating climax. The confrontation between the brothers is described as primal, brutal, the ultimate unavoidable expression of that cursed inheritance they both carry. The tragedy is total.
Okay, so this brings us to the central puzzle. How can one novel by one author seemingly tell two such different stories? One about, like, legislative power and finance, the other about raw, patriarchal, physical power in a swamp. The cloths just don't seem compatible.
Right. They feel mutually exclusive. Yet the sources insist there's a shared core.
So how do we synthesize this? Where's the connection?
This is where we really have to dig deeper, I think. The synthesis isn't about trying to merge the plot points, because you can't. It's about looking at the underlying structures the novel is examining.
Ah, okay. So common themes despite different settings.
Exactly. The big shared theme, the core idea, seems to be the nature of power and inherited ruin. It doesn't matter if the power structure is the cold bureaucratic hierarchy of DC embodied by someone like Whitmore, or the brutal personal patriarchy down the bayou. Lazar White seems to be critiquing any system built on inherited, unaccountable power that demands complicity and just keeps cycles of trauma going.
So, the author uses these two extreme settings, the sterile city and the wild swamp, to argue that this kind of corruption, this inherited ruin, isn't specific to one place or type. It's inherent in the structure itself.
That feels right. Whether it's a political dynasty or a family dynasty, the king figure demands subjects, demands obedience, and the system perpetuates itself.
And the title, King of Ashes, must play into this synthesis then.
Oh, definitely. It works on both levels.
Yeah.
In the political narrative, the ashes are literal, right? The remnants of the corrupt institutions, the destroyed reputations, the loss of public trust that Marcus and Sarah are navigating.
Okay, that makes sense.
But in the Bayou narrative, it's intensely personal, symbolic. Mm-hmm. The sources say Rono's victory, his claiming the throne, is hollow because he becomes a king of ashes ruler over this desolate landscape of grief, trauma, and the completely shattered bond with Zala. He inherits the title, but rules over nothing but ruin.
Wow. Okay, that connects them powerfully through metaphor.
And the narrative technique reinforces this too. Both interpretations highlight the novel's use of multiple perspectives,
giving us access to different characters' thoughts.
Exactly. And that seems very intentional. It gives you intimate access to these conflicting viewpoints, these warring psychologies. You're not just seeing the events. You're inside the heads of people like Sarah Chen, rationalizing her choices in an office, and inside Rono's head as he battles that inherited rage down in the swamp.
And the writing style itself, does it bridge the gap?
Apparently so. The prose is described as blending, you know, lyrical beauty with a very raw honesty. And it uses the setting almost symbolically. The cold, sterile DC environment mirrors the emotional detachment of the political players.
While the tangled, wild swamp reflects Rono's inner turmoil.
Precisely. The external landscape reflects the internal one.
So looking at the bigger picture then, what's the takeaway? Is it about the struggle of the individual against the system?
I think that's a huge part of it. You see characters like Marcus or Zala fighting desperately for their own path for change. But they're constantly up against these massive forces, a political machine, a deeply ingrained family legacy that are, in a way, designed to keep them exactly where they are.
It makes you think about individual effort versus that systemic inertia.
Yeah. And ultimately, the novel seems to turn that question back on you, the reader. It pushes you to examine your own role, maybe even your own quiet complicity, in upholding unequal systems, whether that's at work or in your family, or just through political silence.
It definitely avoids easy moral judgments based on this.
Completely. It's nuanced. The lasting feeling isn't one of neat answers or solutions. It's more this complex, maybe difficult, understanding that fighting back is crucial. But real change is often slow, messy, and full of setbacks.
Confronting those inherited shadows, political or personal, seems key.
That seems to be the only path forward the novel offers, even if it's a path that leads through destruction. Through ashes, you could say. It's about trying to build a self-made life out of that ruin.
A powerful, if sobering, message.
Indeed. It suggests confronting the shadows of inherited power, whether political or familial, is the only path to a self-made life, even if that path leads through ruin.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by a Contra Foundation.